Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Middays with Susie Larson. It's only just a matter of... Welcome to Middays. I'm Susie Larson. So honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, my guest today writes this: at some point in our lives, we are all groomed, prepared, trained, and conditioned for something. That isn't always a bad thing, but for many of us, our grooming had far-reaching negative effects. It took away some of our control and whispered of our unworthiness. What about you? Were you groomed for appearance? Like how things appear matter most of all? Were you groomed to be seen and not heard, to be invisible? Maybe you were groomed just to endure, you know? You just have to get through it. You have to endure. Maybe you were groomed for judgment, that there's a strong sense of black and white, of us and them, right and wrong, and it was all about rules. Maybe you were groomed for financial fear. Maybe there was a scarcity mindset for you, and you always feared, and you still do, not having enough. And maybe you live in a beautiful big house and have a great income, yet you still have an orphan mindset. How were you groomed? Well, we're going to examine the messages we received when we were younger and how they shaped our values and self-worth. Elizabeth Melendez Fisher-Good joins me today to talk about her book, Groomed, Overcoming the Message That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. And this is a powerful book. I think I read 90% of this book to get ready for today's interview. I wanted to read less because you can't read full books every single day when you're doing a talk show every single day, but I couldn't. I had to read all of it as much as I could because it's fantastic. And I really am praying that God starts to unearth some things for you today and starts a healing process that you maybe didn't expect. We'll get Elizabeth on in just a moment. I just got to make a quick announcement. We are a listener-supported ministry. Thousands upon thousands of folks from around the world, really tens of thousands, every single day are encouraged in their faith through Faith Radio because of you and your generous gifts. And I just wanted to pause to say you're making a difference all over the world. That's your fruit. And I want to just say thank you. I may be biased, but I believe we have the best listeners in the world. So thank you. Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Elizabeth Melendez Fisher-Good is CEO and co-founder of Sela Freedom and the Sela Way Foundation, which exists to prevent sexual abuse, exploitation, and sex trafficking of children and young adults. She speaks and trains internationally and is passionate about protecting our youth from the secrets of abuse that so many are forced to keep. She has three beautiful children, lives with her husband in Sarasota, Florida. And before we say hey to her, I want to remind you, we've got four copies of Groomed, Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. And I want to say, even though her work is very much in the human trafficking exploitation world, this book is really for every single one of us because we were all groomed in one way or another. You want in on the drawing, text the word book to 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Hey, Elizabeth, so good to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Susie.
Looking forward to this conversation. You've written a really amazing and an important book, and I'm so excited to dig into it. And I already know I've got more notes than time, so I gotta be wise here.
Thank you so much. It's awesome.
Absolutely. So let's start here. We love to start with talking scripture, and I know you love God's word. Is there a verse that's kind of a go-to for you these days, or one you've been pondering?
You know, it's been a season of be still and know that I am God. I'm just like watching strategically. God is doing so much, and I just don't want to get in the way and mess it up. I'm just trying to pause, Selah, just not get in the middle of it.
Very good.
He's doing a lot.
And those are especially the times to hide under the shadow of his wing and let him fight for you and make a way for you. And that's great. So give us a little backstory, if you would, Elizabeth, on your journey.
Well, how far back? What would you like me to begin with?
Yes. Well, you were a church girl. Let's start with that. Then things took a dramatic shift for you.
Yeah, you know, I was that perfect little girl that was so into God and church and Jesus. I was raised in, you know, a Baptist church in Chicago, and my mom's family was a Pentecostal, actually holiness church in Arkansas. I was in Awana, you know, the Awana Olympics and competitions. I was girl of the year in Awana. Like, I think that's the plumb line, quite honestly, that saved my life, because I was so rooted at such a young age, thank God. But it also was a place where I had just great, great things happen. I want to say tragedy, you know, things that just lightning bolt and change everything in a second too. So it's been an interesting, interesting journey from there.
Mm. Well, once you were there, I think your parents split. I think you had some financial hardship, and you had a favorite place you'd go every summer to visit your I think it was your mom's family, and that became a favorite place until one day trauma struck.
Yeah, I think even prior to that, you know, my sister was accidentally killed.
And yes.
Yeah, and that sort of laid the benchwork for what I now, looking back, you know, the groom to be invisible and not say anything and just sort of, you don't matter that much. You know, I think my grief of losing my sister really defined me in ways that I'm still making sense of, you know, how deeply it affected me. So that later, when I did visit my mom's family, I used to go every summer. So after my sister died, Arkansas was 1,000% my getaway. It was my summer retreat. I would name horses as they were born and have baby chicks. And it was just the most idyllic, beautiful part of my life that was still intact. And then I had, you know, an incident happen when I was getting ready for church one morning. And one of the people that I had known forever literally came up behind me and just sort of molested me a bit. And as I was brushing my hair in the bathroom, came in and sort of just did this thing and was looking in the mirror while he did it. And it was so shocking. I was about 12 that I couldn't even, there was no words. You know, you would think you would raise your child to be like, hey, what are you doing? And I just was silent. And then he just came out of the bathroom as like, I will picture like a snake coming in and coming out. And then I ended up in a car with him later on at a different time that day and had his hand and went up my skirt and more things and just sort of rocked me because I never had a fear or a doubt or a distrust and couldn't even imagine. But I went into the bathroom and I was silent. I didn't say a word. And I just sat there and cried. And then I'm like, okay, well, I've learned my tears don't matter. I should probably just keep this inside too. Everybody doesn't need to hear it. And I just went out and pretended it never happened.
And just for the record, you went into the bathroom and he stepped up to lead worship. And you know, I just want to back up a little bit on this story because you were 5 years old. You had a sister who was, I think, 9 years older than you. How much older was she than you?
Yeah, I was six when she died and she was nine years older. Yeah.
And she was 15, very, 16. Very much like a mom to you. She loved you. And the story that you tell, she kisses you on the head. She tucks you in bed, tells you how much she loves you. She walks down the hall, and your brother, who is versed in, he was a hunter, he was versed in how to take care of a gun, but for some reason, as she's walking down the hallway, the gun goes off, hits her in the temple. She's killed, and you're ushered away from that home for 2 weeks with a relative, so you never got to be a part of you never got to really grieve. You never got to be part of the funeral. And one of the things that just stuck out to me is your little girl at a wedding, a few weeks later, crumpled in a little heap in a corner crying, and a relative asked, what's wrong with you? And you said, I miss my sister. And she's like, you're far too young to remember anything about her. I don't want to rush past that part, Elizabeth, because talk about how that really did set the stage where your feelings really don't matter.
Right. She's like, you're too young. You don't even remember her. Oh, my God.
Wow.
I do. I just remember thinking, oh, my goodness. Okay, I shouldn't even be feeling all of this, you know, because you don't know. You're a kid. I shouldn't be feeling all this. I don't, you know, don't remember her as much as everyone else. And just dip. And I think because it was so tragic and I was the youngest of so many cousins and aunts and uncles and this really emotional family, everybody was just a mess. It was such a tragic accident that not intentionally, like in hindsight, of course, no one meant to ignore me. But I think that my grief, it was processed alone, completely alone.
And then you have this trauma, and if you friends are interested in the story, you'll have to read the book Groomed. But I want to just pause here and say, you know, when you've endured sexual trauma, it's not uncommon to lose any sense of boundary when it comes to your body. And that's what's so painful for people who don't understand that. You're so confused about what happened that sometimes you allow other things to happen, and people can say, well, you could have said no, or you could have walked away, whatever. But you're really messed up in the way of personal boundaries, aren't you, when that kind of thing happens?
1,000%. I mean, one of the things that I am so known for saying is there's no such thing as a seventh grade slut. You know, you see these kids get so mean by sixth and seventh grade and be like, oh, so-and-so, she's such a slut. I'm like, this is a little girl that has clearly had every boundary taken from her sexually. It doesn't even know how to say no anymore. It already doesn't matter that she's allowing boys to do whatever they want. So there's so many red flags and telltale signs that we just need to know to look for when you can tell a child's just in pain. But absolutely, your gateway is broken, completely broken, and your brain is so upside down, 100%.
Oh, people could understand that. You said women who experience sexual abuse or assault, and especially those who never told anyone, are more likely to struggle with depression, eating disorders, anxiety, and shame. They're also more likely to enter an abusive relationship. Boy, that's important to know. We're going to pause here. When we come back, we're going to talk about this question that you often ask folks, and it's this: what was your first secret? And friends, I want you to think about that. Again, because Elizabeth Ministry is towards those who face sexual exploitation and abuse and are recovering their lives, I don't want you to think for a moment that that's all this book is about. It's an important book. But you have a secret. What was your first secret? Because there's information there. That first trauma, that first thing that you felt like couldn't tell anybody, says a lot about how you work to be okay today, unless God's really gone in there already and healed it. So let's talk about that on the other side of the break, why it's important to maybe face that very first secret. I'm talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher-Good, and her book is titled Groomed: Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. We will get into those five common ways we're groomed: an appearance, to be invisible, to endure, for judgment, financial fear, a little bit later in the program. Don't go away, and don't forget to text BOOK if you want in on the drawing to 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. God is on a rescue mission. He sent his son to live, to die for us. And it's salvation of the soul is such an amazing gift, but so often people stop there. You know, my eternity is secure. His salvation, the gospel, is all-encompassing. He cares about the human condition. He cares about your story, the twists, the turns, the losses, the hurts. I'm talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher-Good. Her book is titled Groomed: Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. And five of the ways that we're groomed that we'll get to in a little bit, but I just want to just to kind of perk your interest a bit. Groomed for appearance. Maybe that's how you were just raised. Great, great parents, but how things looked mattered most of all. Maybe you were groomed to be invisible, to be seen, not heard. Or to endure, just endure, that's your call. Or for judgment, you're kind of a black and white person, us and them. Or for financial fear, you've got a scarcity mindset. We'll get into those in a bit. But Elizabeth, I thought it was interesting that you often ask folks, what was your first secret? I want you to talk about why that's such an important question to answer.
Well, I think it goes back to the root of everything, because what I have found, I mean, I received my master's in clinical psych probably 20-some years ago, getting old. And so often people come trying to fix their symptoms. You know, I have this symptom, I'm dealing with this, I can't stop shopping, I can't stop eating, I can't stop, you know, whatever it is. The symptom that they're focused on is never really what needs to be dealt with. And spending time throwing money at, you know, solutions there is never going to be the long-term solution. And for me, it's shocking how even now when something comes up, it usually stems back to my sister. And so that was what happened before any sexual abuse. And it's just amazing to me, like the messaging that false sense of responsibility that was created in me as a child when I just had my world shocked and rocked and, you know, thrown upside down, that created the basis for how I handle everything in life and relationships. And I could have spent a lot of time talking about a sexual part or an eating disorder, or, you know, I went to Overeaters Anonymous for a little while there. But it's literally getting all the way to the root. And then you watch stuff fall away. It's like once healing comes at the deepest level, I've seen symptoms just go. They just go.
Yeah. Got a counselor friend who said this very thing. She said all of her colleagues would say exactly what she said to me over lunch. She said, we are seeing so many patients with crazy physiological symptoms, and doctors aren't able to give diagnoses. Sometimes they'll kind of label it autoimmune, but they don't really have definitive diagnosis until these gals get into a counselor, and even men as well, and they start to unravel those hurts. And when the love of God gets into those places, as you say, one symptom after another, just falls away.
Healing. Yep.
Yeah. Healing happens. You write this: our painful secrets are as diverse as we are, and so are the results. They emerge from moments of trauma, whether those come from accidents, negligence, or intentional actions of others. And yet we all assume that since everyone around us seems fine, we're alone in our pain. And, you know, my friend who's a counselor has talked about the two types of trauma: things that have happened that shouldn't have happened, things that didn't happen that should have happened. And don't you think, Elizabeth, we minimize that trauma when we compare it to someone else? Let's say you didn't have somebody who loved you or said it. You know, their parents, they stayed together, they worked their jobs, but they never held you. They never said, I love you, I'm proud of you. Mm-hmm. The absence of such things is traumatic for the soul, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we just justify it. We look around and you compare your insides to other people's outsides and you're like, well, my life can't be that bad. I mean, I had a good house. I lived in this neighborhood, but it was deprived of love, or it was deprived of touch, or it was deprived of, you know, all these different components that I think we have such a hard time allowing ourselves to just acknowledge and grieve and be okay with that grief, because you're right, it manifests in many ways if we don't let ourselves go there.
When you talked about how you and your brother were raised by the same parents, but you're totally different. You're a big city life girl, social affairs, and he likes to stay close to home with a small group of friends. I'm a little bit more like your brother, I'll just admit. But, you know, I just got to say, introvert, you know, I love to be home. But you said part of who we are is just how God wired us. And you say, who you really are at your core is entirely yours. But until you learn to look critically at how social messages have affected you and begin to challenge the ones that don't enhance your life, they will keep leading you down a disappointing dark path. You got to make that distinction for us, because there are some things that you say that we're wired for, but others we may accept, we absolutely should not accept.
Yeah, you're right. It's interesting to think about, because, you know, am I ultimately more introverted at my core? Yeah. I mean, I get my energy definitely when I'm alone, but I could turn it on. I could go, I could be out there. And kids are born that way. I have three children. One of them, he hates when we go to New York. He's like, I don't want to walk around the city. I have two of them that all they want to do is live in New York. One's already living in New York. But you also have this reality that there comes a point where you have to look at what messages were drilled into you and you were groomed for. And I, you know, I'm going through it with one of my children, two of my children right now, where they're like, you know, I had these messages that were, I just was supposed to do this and supposed to do that. I'm like, oh my gosh, I groomed my own kids, you know, because you're so busy. My one child said to me, you know, you just did nothing but push your beliefs on me. And it's so interesting, because I said, because here I am writing this book from my perspective, right, having been groomed, and now I have these 20-something late teen kids, and saying to me, well, you put your messages all into me. And it's so interesting, like, we have to all pause and wonder if every other generation just flip-flops the messaging, because we're so reactive to not wanting to pass to our kids what we had happen. And then we go, the pendulum swings over messaging this way. And then they're like so over messaged that their pendulum will swing the next way. And just getting back to, you know, what is my truth? And what is it that I know, that I know, that I know, that I know, that I am passionate about, that I care about, that I want to have a voice for? Because it's so, so drilled into us. And like the book says, it's not always a bad intent. Sometimes it's the best intent to protect. And it's just, and you'll find what I also find fascinating, and people are always like, oh, I just want to talk about that. The things that we don't speak about somehow get repeated in the next generation. So I just think there's such power in putting things on the table, and maybe not in just a protective way, because you don't want it to repeat itself, but just the ability to speak about it as our kids are getting older and giving them the freedom to understand why this messaging came from you. And hey, if it doesn't feel right, examine it. And I just think it's, for me, it's the very first time in the last couple of months hitting me from both sides, above me and then below me, which I think is an interesting situation.
I wonder how often, I mean, when you're even parenting with the best of intentions and there's fear in the motivation, I would imagine that's when it feels like you're pushing a message into your children. But when there's soul healing and you can really be so free in your own soul that you can, you know, sow seeds into your kids and impart truths, but you can open your hands to say, you know, this is your story and God's, where I don't need you to turn out like me or not do what I mean. When fear drives it, I would imagine you see more often that pendulum swing. What do you say?
100%. And I think, you know, the beauty of how many of us get our full healing before our children are born. Like, I think of how I raised my kids the first 10 to 12 years versus the last 10 to 12 years. It's really night and day. You know, I had a huge breakthrough 15, 16 years ago, that prior to that, I was operating with such blinders on. And that was a big part of the imprint on all three of my children, you know, when I was operating out of my own pain, but not fully open or aware of it yet. The gifting, that's why, you know, when I see somebody really, really trying to figure it out in their early 20s, what a gift. And even though I thought I was, I only had a piece of the puzzle. It didn't really start coming all the way into, you know, perfect clarity, which of course it always is evolving, right? But yeah, for me, to my mid-30s, and then now here I am at 50, I just think we're always learning. So giving the permission that, hey, I may have screwed up back there, honey.
Mm-hmm. And God can redeem it all. Mm-hmm.
Yes, 1,000%. I don't think we get it right, but just the openness of speaking about it, speaking to everything. You know, there's some things in my family, through some of the family members, that are just still unspeakable. That doesn't matter. Time hasn't changed it.
Hmm. Well, Elizabeth, we got about 2 minutes to our hard break, and you may want to carry this answer over to the other side. But there was a point, you know, when you would go to your mom's family and you had the farm and you were naming the horses, and it was this healing place, especially given the grief, unspoken grief in your own home, your dad leaving. There was so much imploding in your personal home. So to be able to go to this farm and enjoy such time and to have that thing completely upended by a worship pastor who molests you, it's just infuriating to me. But when you drove away that time, you told your mom, I never want to go back again. And your mom never questioned you. You got to say a word about that. Bless your mom. And this isn't faulting your mom, but in the no-talk rule homes, those should be major conversations. So say a word if you would.
Well, I just think it speaks to the generational brokenness and the generational secrets. You know, it took me years to realize the pain that me saying that she had to know. And later in life, she said, you know, was it so-and-so? And I'm like, how did you know? You know, so it's the knowing, but the not wanting to say, you know, because if I say I know, I'm going to have to acknowledge everything that happened to me. And I think that's one of the biggest wounds and generational patterns that we have going in America.
And yet I wonder how much more healing, or at least healing, would have been accelerated if people would have put a flag in the ground and said, absolutely not. And they would call it out. They would fight for you. They would say, this is not okay. This guy, you're not okay. I mean, what a difference that would have made in your life, you know?
All you would long for. When I find a child that was advocated for, all of the difference in the world. Majority didn't have it. It's a rare, rare gift. So I'm praying this book helps the freedom flow for more people, because that's what we need. We need to speak to it and give the freedom that, oh my gosh, this is not okay and not on my watch, and it is not your fault.
Very good. All right. On the other side, we're going to talk about what it looks like if you've been groomed for appearance. What are kind of some of the indicators, somebody who's been raised where appearance is what matters? And why does that matter? It does, you know. Talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher Good, and her book is titled Groomed, Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. You know what? God wants you free. We want you free. We're having conversations like this, and sometimes it unearths some painful memories, but it's worth it because you're on your way to freedom. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks for tuning in to Middays. I'm Susie Larson talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher Good about her book, Groomed, Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. I've got four copies if you want to get in on the drawing. Just text the word book to 877-933-2484. So how does a person know if they've been groomed for appearance, Elizabeth?
Well, I think it's because we're always assessing the role we're playing and how we're coming across, and who we're positioning and whose eyes are going to be on us and the affirmation that we're going for. Many ways.
And you say that when you meet a woman groomed for appearances, you notice that she loves to talk about what she's doing and about the important people in her life. She's organized and agreeable. But when you try and ask her questions about herself, what she dreams about, that's where things get tangled. Unpack that a bit more.
Well, I think until we have our epiphany and our breakthrough, I mean, prior to me really, you know, getting to the heart of the places I needed to have Jesus touch my life and my heart and be fully healed, I was really achievement oriented, and I was raised, you know, both of my parents were very, my dad had just come over from Puerto Rico when he was 15 with three younger sisters, didn't speak, you know, the language, had to get everybody figured out in school. And his family was very, very much about not, you know, acclimating only in a Puerto Rican area. They moved to a Jewish area. He was always trying to move and not be only this and only that. And he really, that was like a strong imprint. My mom was from very rural Arkansas. So those two worlds, there was, I think it just came with a degree of insecurity. And, you know, we want to fit, we want to be better, look better. And that messaging in my life and my childhood was very strong. I was very aware when my dad was happy with me and how I presented. And I was very aware when he was not. And I adore the man. He is a force to be reckoned with, and he is dynamic in all kinds of ways. But growing up, I was very conscious that, you know, as a Latin man, very into how women looked and very much into all outward appearances. And and achievements for our family was about achievements. So I knew when I did something that made him proud, and I knew, interestingly enough, no matter what it was, it seemed like it could, like I remember being in grad school and finishing grad school and doing fantastic and getting a job right out of undergraduate. I mean, just, I pretty much pushed myself so hard for that approval. And it would always be, well, you're so smart. You know, I think about it, you really could have been a neurosurgeon. I'm like, oh, geez. And then even when he had businesses rolling out and different cousins in the family, he would ask to model for some of the product line that I was never asked. I was like, wow. And so I worked harder and harder. I think that it was like combined with coming out of groomed to be invisible. And if I get it right, then I'm really going to be, you know, I need to work myself. So I actually think I worked myself into the perfect trophy wife until I came out the other side of it, quite honestly. It's interesting. Mm.
Well, when you think about that, when you're groomed for appearance, a lot of times the appeared outcome looks very positive. So explain why it's a problem. I mean, there's obvious implications of it. You're not free, and it's no way to live, and it's not even a sustainable way to live. So how you look on the outside is not at all connected with what's on the inside. So maybe answer this instead.
No.
What is the revelation? How does a person, I'm thinking of men listening today, who know this is true about them. On one hand, they're gifted and they can pull a lot off. But on the other hand, they're not enjoying their success because it's coming from a motivation that's holding them captive.
Well, when it never feels like it's enough and it never feels good enough and you're never really content and sitting in that place in your spirit that you know you're where you're meant to be, I think that's a huge indicator. And, you know, I'll watch, you know, there's just different people that are always doing something. When you're in your passion and you're in your purpose and what you're created to do, it's a path and you can see that happening. But it's when you watch, and I did this, you know, I'm not judging, believe me, many, many years, you know, I'm doing this and I'm doing this and I'm doing this and I'm the perfect birthday party planner and I'm this and I'm that. And it's when it's so much because I didn't really yet know what my purpose and calling was because I was still so numb to the depth of my pain. I was just trying to look good in all these ways and trying to overachieve in all these ways because with enough accolades, I might feel better one day. And I think that's at the heart and the root of it. And so we really, really allow that healing. I think the question that you asked, that root healing, actually helps define often what our true purpose is.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're not working so hard to be okay. And I wonder how many, you know, high-level corporate leaders, CFOs, you know, CEOs, men who are thriving in the marketplace, or it looks like that, but I wonder how many have father wounds or have trauma, and they're just working hard, but they're working hard to be okay. So the revelation of God's love and a chance to slow down and get healed would be life-changing for you.
Yeah.
So I pray that for you. How about this one, groomed to be invisible?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one. And for me, you know, and I think the thing is for people to say, okay, I don't have to pick one. I'm only groomed to endure. I was only groomed to be invisible. I've had all of them in different seasons of my life. And sometimes I've had multiple ones always, you know, at the same time. But the invisible for me, what's so interesting is because now people that know me, they're like, oh, please, how could anyone not notice you? I mean, seriously, for my whole probably first 20 years, I felt invisible, like to the point I could cry invisible, like very invisible. And I think it's because the depth of the pain I was in, and I was just trying to survive, and I was doing anything I could to just make it through. And I remember being little, because even after my sister died, so I was starting second grade, and I'd gone to one school for kindergarten and first grade. She died the summer between first and second grade, and that's why I had to start a new school. So I'm on a new bus, new school. My friends all got divided. We all went to different, you know, there's three schools we got split into. I get into this new school. She died in August. School started, right, in the beginning of September. Not one person knew that I even had a sister or what my tragedy was, or that there's not one teacher. Nowadays, there would be, you know, counselors meeting me at school, right? No one. And so I was like, okay, so it doesn't exist here either. So I just act like everything's normal and just going about my business. And it just takes away, because she was the only one that actually, quite honestly, made me feel super special. So here I am like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, keep my head down. And I remember probably 2 weeks into school, someone coming up to me and saying, oh, I'm sorry about your sister. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe she just said that. Does she know we're not supposed to talk about it? And for some reason, from that point on, I feel like teachers never saw me. And it's true. Like if you bring me back to a high school reunion or a junior high reunion, no teacher remembers me. I was but I think when you feel that way, you become invisible. And then as I got older, I tried, I remember starting when I worked at, NBC Chicago, or when I was at a radio station prior to working at the television stations, I would do all I could to just get up on time and get out the door. And then I would just leave feeling so too heavy, not pretty enough, something, you know, I don't look noticeable. No one's going to remember me. And I remember like I would stop ridiculously. I could tell you the phone number, 312-781-1000 Marshall Fields on State Street. I would buy a new outfit because I felt so background and so invisible, and I'd go to work, and it was such a battle. But I think for me, I do believe that Satan will take our wounds and he will use them so hard against us. Because here I am in these high profile media jobs, but yet acting as if I wasn't there and I wasn't noticed, and that you project, I think what we really feel inside, we project outwardly. So for me, it was like being on a double hamster wheel. I was working so hard to be in these places, but I felt so unworthy. And like, I was just the bottom of the barrel everywhere I went. And it was just such a mental, like, I just remember being mentally exhausted all the time.
Yeah. Cause that's not how God wants you to operate. Now you had trauma that really groomed you for invisible, but what does that look like in another setting? Maybe it doesn't look like trauma, but the message still is the same. You're kind of to be seen, not heard.
Yeah.
What is that? What are the indicators for someone listening today?
Oh yeah. One of my great friends and co-founders, when she was a child, her mother just never complimented her, never noticed her, didn't ask her opinion ever. They would have conversations. She wouldn't be included in any of the conversations. And she was an only child. And she just grew up. She had no trauma, absolutely no trauma ever. And literally just felt, I'm not important enough. I don't matter. And then as we come through later in life, this is a woman that she's brilliant. She's probably one of the most wisdom-holding women I know. And when you are in a circle with her and there's maybe even 3-4 people sitting around, wouldn't exert herself, wouldn't say a word. And then, you know, learning over the time that I've been with her to start asking, you know, now she's come out of it, but she never would have spoken up because she was groomed to know that her voice doesn't matter. And that really needed to know what she thought.
Yeah, well, appreciate that. Some who first appear as peacemakers are actually peacekeepers. And you kind of make a bit of a distinction in the book, because it can look like someone's really like, you know, being a conduit to peace, but what they're doing is trying to keep the peace. And that's coming from a total different place. Maybe make that distinction if you will.
Well, I was just, you know, reading and learning more about it. As you know, you write this stuff and you start living it out and watching people talk about it, and how Jesus, you know, he didn't keep the peace by turning a blind eye or by not speaking into something. And I do think that's the people get credit. Like she was credited for, oh, she's such a peacemaker. She's so kind. She's so, you know, she'll never say anything bad. But in reality, she didn't want to cause a ripple, because she didn't think she had enough value to say what she thought. So with the opposite, you know, and it's been really fantastic. We've been you know, leading this organization together for 10 years. And we've helped heal each other even to different levels, because I will call her out in crowds and say, let's let Lori speak. She has something so important to say. Let's hear what she has to say. And when you create space, you know, she was able to get her voice and have that strength. And now she leads our core values. She trains on conflict resolution and healthy communication, and came out of that place. But again, how old are we now that we finally, you know, 10 years ago are getting these breakthroughs? And I think that's why I'm so passionate about this book, because anyone reading it, if you're younger in your 20s and 30s, men and women, like, we are not created to stay in a set mold and a set role. And if in your heart and your spirit you feel that you are looked over, like, that is not your personality profile that you're supposed to stay stuck in. There is such mm-hmm. value, and that silence is something that needs to be lifted off. And I mm-hmm. see it again and again. It's like, yeah, right? Don't they say, like, in a board of directors, you have your slow speakers and your fast speakers, or any group. And if the fast speakers aren't trained to have enough discernment to make room for the slow speakers, you're robbing that room of half of the voices that it needs.
There
you have to
go.
Be so conscious. Yeah. Mm.
Very good. You say, too, that friends oftentimes will call these invisible people, call them givers, but behind their back, they see them as doormats. We're going to pause here, and when we come back, we'll look at if you're groomed to endure, groomed for judgment, and hopefully we can get to the financial fear one. But I want to read this again as we're going out to break. Just want you to hear this again. Who you really are at your core, well, that's entirely yours. But until you learn to look critically at how social messages have affected you and begin to challenge the ones that don't enhance your life, well, they'll keep leading you down the same disappointing dark path. That's what we're talking about today. If you can really discern one way, God made you so wonderfully, fearfully, but there are things you've experienced that have shaped you that are holding you back. What are those things? Talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher Good. Her book is titled Groomed, Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. We've got 4 copies. I want you to text the word book to get in on the drawing. 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. Tuning in to Middays, I'm Susie Larson talking to Elizabeth Melendez Fisher Good, and her book is titled Groomed, Overcoming the Messages That Shaped Our Past and Limit Our Future. And we're just delving into exploring the idea of being groomed, and sometimes it's the culture around you. Sometimes it's the traumas that you've experienced, things that happened that shouldn't have, or things that didn't happen that should have happened. And I often say that devil sees your potential long before you ever do. Well, we've got 4 copies of this book. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. So, Elizabeth, we've talked about what it means to be groomed for appearance and groomed to be invisible. What does it look like when we've been groomed to endure?
That one's like my mantra. Because it has such a double-edged sword, and what you said is 1,000% accurate. The enemy knows, like, if he can't get us in the womb, he wants to get us by 3, 4, 5 years old to just drill something so hard against the messaging of what we were created to be that we come into agreement with a lie. And I think coming through the series of traumas that I did, if you read the book, you'll, you know, learn a little bit more, but the way that I handled them was, oh, that's okay. No, I'm fine. No, I'm fine. I got it. I'm fine. No, I'm fine. And that carried on. Not only, I mean, what's interesting is that I always ran to counseling. I tried to find help, but I wasn't allowing Jesus to go deep enough. He had to, like, come and just invade me finally in my 30s and really bring me to healing. But I think the pain, you just get groomed to be okay with so much. And I mean, there's so many adults, men, women, that what you said, I think, is accurate. This is the most successful people we were groomed to endure. And one of my counselors would try to get me to really get to this point of healing way back. And I said, you know, if you got everybody too healthy, you'd have no CEOs. You would take the drive out of all of us.
Right, right.
Because we can push, you know, so there's a beauty to it, but it's also knowing and giving yourself permission to say no and to not be okay with that. I think one of the things I bring out in the book is the first time a girlfriend said to me, are you really okay with that? Because prior to that, I wouldn't even take a second to think about it. Of course I'm okay with it. I can handle anything. I've endured plenty. This is nothing. I got it. and it would just keep evolving. And these shades of gray, you find yourself living things that none of us were intended to tolerate, you know, bleeding into abusive situations and relationships.
You said that those who are groomed to endure may see themselves as role models, but are unaware of the cost to their souls. That's just huge. So if you just, if you're that, I got it. But you don't. There's a discrepancy in your soul. And even like you were saying, Elizabeth, there's a point where you maybe kind of believed that, but you weren't okay on the inside. And it wasn't until God really did kind of pursue you in the most powerful, passionate way that light started to shine in the darkness. And then when you started to, well, hopefully we can get to that story. And if not, you'll have to read the book. But it's like he initiated the healing process in you, and that was absolutely powerful. But I'm looking at my clock here. So let's jump on to Groomed for Judgment. Yeah. What does that one look like?
That's, well, I think that goes back to, you know, the church girl. And I think the just reconciling the messaging. In spite of the different pain and different things I went through in my church communities as I was growing up, I still really had some hardcore, like you said, black and white beliefs. You know, like one of them is, I don't believe in divorce. You know, my parents, what I think is so interesting, my parents got divorced at 24 years. And when you're young, you're like, 24 years? Why are you getting divorced now? My gosh, just die married. What does it matter? Like, you've been married so long. What are you doing now? And when did I get divorced? 21, 22 years. I mean, in the judgment, I have a section in the book where I talk about never vows and the very things that we are so, I'll never do this and I'll never do that. And those come from pain and fear and judgment. And those are the things that we literally are so not, we hold a judgment against a person or a situation. And then we put that vow out there that, well, that'll never be me. I'll never allow that to happen. And just the very nature of that is like the perfect setup for Satan to be, oh, let me show you. And I just find it interesting because we're not allowing the healing that needs to happen there or the forgiveness that needs to happen there. I wouldn't have had a never vow if I had let myself get to the place of truly, truly finding the compassion or understanding what really happened with my parents or maybe processing it with somebody. And I just think that the never vows are based off of, you know, fears, wounds, and judgments. And that's how we end up groomed to judge a lot of our black and white childhood things.
You write this, a woman groomed for judgment assures you that there's freedom to be found in so many rules and security in a God is hard and security in a God who's hard on anyone who steps out of line. She portrays a kind of holy perfection, sanctified and subservient, and her intentions are good. She desires to live a faithful, holy life to honor her core beliefs, but she's been groomed to see the world as us and them, and she likes to be a part of the us. And I found this very interesting. You said when you've seen a person groomed for judgment, they tend to go one of two ways. They either follow the groomer's example and try to fit into that narrow black and white box of obedience, or they rebel completely. Wow. Say a word more, if you would.
Well, I think that it's just so interesting. You want so badly to not appear as the one that has had the pain, right? And you so much, like for me, I literally, when I was in my early 20s, my late 20s, even my early 30s, I had leadership roles, major leadership roles in church. I was teaching small groups and director of training and equipping, and I was so broken. And I was so full of judgments and telling everybody, this is how you have to have a relationship, and this is how you are, this is how you. And because I so much wanted to make that be true for my life, so much wanted to not be the broken one, wanted to be the one that looked good and had it together and her kids look good and her marriage looks good and everything looks good because I lived in the pain of it looking horrific and broken. And I think that is why, you know, the most humbling thing, you know, like what did it say, humble yourself and the Lord will do it for you. I mean, when I couldn't do it any longer, when I couldn't make everything look good, when I couldn't keep up that image, it was very humiliating to me. I want to say humbling, but even a heavier word is humiliating because I took that horrific judgment platform and I didn't have the compassion for the people in hindsight. I'm like, oh, look at what I didn't, you know, have the tender heart towards. And for me, when I finally, in like my hair was falling out and I mean, I couldn't stay in the marriage. It was just horrifically affecting me physically, every way, mentally. And I remember just being so embarrassed that everyone was going to know, look at her, she ended up in divorce. We knew, she, you know, like the message in my mind is we knew she would, or, you know, somehow the whole cover that, you know, I'd been holding together. And then as people started saying to me, we're so glad that you're done. We're so glad, you know, we saw. And then that was even more humiliating. So like, I thought all that time I was covering things well. And I just think that this judgment thing, I don't know that I would have tried that hard if I didn't have that messaging drilled into me. And I mean, it's a horrible, horrible example. And I don't want listeners to think, oh man, when it's bad, you just get divorced. That's not true. But I think when all you hear again and again and again is God hates divorce, the messaging is not equal to God hates emotionally abusive situations. God hates, you know, there's a lot of things God hates. And we hold up certain platforms in the church. And when you come from your own wounds related to it, you hold up that platform right with them, you know?
When someone's coming across as black and white, and people who've walked through trauma, there's no grace or compassion for them as they're trying to sort it out. You know, behind the judgment is their own kind of fear and their own undealt with stuff, mm-hmm. you know? And let's see if we can get to this one, groomed for financial fear. And I want to read this excerpt and just have you speak to it. You said, whether the message that groomed you were set out in a life of abundance or absence, you were left without a feeling of peace or security. You learned that it was dangerous to desire more than what you had because you'd be disappointed over and over. That insecurity probably made you a strong, resourceful person. Not being a financial burden on anyone was important to you, but no matter what you earned, it was never enough to fill the hole that fear carved in your heart. You spent your whole life holding your breath, waiting for something terrible to happen. So I would imagine, again, just like the other example, this could go one of two ways. You could self-sabotage and stay kind of in a poverty mindset, or drive like crazy and have all kinds of money but still have a fear of scarcity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think no matter where you land, if you haven't had that healing in that place, that the Lord is a God of abundance. And you know what? It's like the widow and the oil. He will provide and he will take care of us if we stay open to where he's guiding us and showing us where to go. Because I have had very little in my life and I have had abundance of wealth in my life. I've lived all different sides of the coin, but the messaging drilled into me a little is there was not enough. So, and I do see that, like when I lived in the North Shore of Chicago, you know, there'd be some that just seemed really at peace, that they were just comfortable and everything was planned for and everything was great. And some that really were always, you know, no, we can't get a babysitter. We can't afford a babysitter. I'm thinking, you're living in a $2 million house. You can't get a babysitter. But I think that for me, I had messaging drilled in at a young age that there's just not, oh no, there's not enough for that. There's not enough for that. And I found myself just the other day, my youngest is driving now. He just got his license and we were talking about getting him a car. And, you know, there was different seasons in life where we couldn't afford to buy a kid a car. And now we can. And my son said to me, you know what, Mom, just because you're used to that messaging, it doesn't mean you have to, because I'm always like, you got to work, get this. And I do believe that the kids need to work, they need to contribute. But it was just such a mantra of, it's not okay to provide so much. It's not okay. And then I found myself just the other day saying to my son, you know what, honey, we have enough. There's enough. You know, you're going to contribute this or that, but there's enough. God is so abundant. And like, no one ever said that to me as a child. Like, that's just such a different message.
Like, yeah.
The way that we position and speak and, hey, you know, there might be decisions not to spend it, but there's always enough, you know, and even running a not-for-profit, people are like, oh, there's such a competition. There's no money. There is an abundance of money in this world. There is enough. And it's like putting ourselves and allowing ourselves to get into the positions and letting God show us what he has. And it's just, it's a mindset change. And it's sort of releasing, like from having our hands so tightly clenched out of fear.
I got to jump in. So
really?
Sorry, Elizabeth. We're up on a hard stop here. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today, friends. Check out her book, Groomed. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Hope you found some encouragement and we will meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this Middays with Susie Larson podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the show, you can subscribe to the podcast today at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Thanks for listening to Middays with Susie Larson.